good morning. We have a full courtroom today. One of the reasons that we do is we have some students with us today. My notes tell me that Loyal High School is here. If they are, would you please stand with your advisors? Oh my, wonderful. You may be seated. The students are here with a program, in a program called Court with Class, which the Supreme Court sponsors in coordination with the State Bar of Wisconsin, and they receive some information about the case, so they know a little bit about what you all are going to be talking to us about today. And then at the lunch break, if they can, justice from the court will come and speak with them, not about this particular case, but about how the Supreme Court operates and how it fits in with our court system. And today, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley is going to meet with the students, if they can stay after the second case this morning, at the lunch break. Now, I've had the students stand up so we can get a peek at them. I'd like to introduce the court now to the students. On my far right, Justice Michael Gabelman. Next to him, Justice David Prosser. Next to me, Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I'm Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. Next on my left, again, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Next to her, Justice Annette Ziegler. And on the far left, Justice Rebecca Bradley. So with all those introductions taken care of, are you all ready to proceed? Please begin.
May it please the court, I'm John Fredrickson, and I represent petitioner David Marks. Mr. Marks has joined me in the courtroom here today. The primary issue that Mr. Marks brings before the court today concerns the proper balancing of Wisconsin's Four Corners Duty to Defend test. In order to restore balance to the test, we ask this court to hold that insurers are barred from considering policy exclusions when conducting a Four Corners duty to defend analysis. Barring the use of exclusions in a duty to defend test is the better rule of law in Wisconsin for the following three reasons. It counterbalances Wisconsin's current bar on introduction of extrinsic evidence. It promotes bargain for coverage expectations of both the insurer and the insured. And it best comports with the natural evolution of the law, both in Wisconsin and nationally. Mr. Marks has also raised, and this court has certified, the issues of whether the Court of Appeals has the power to overrule itself, and whether a policy can be deemed entirely illusory.
Counsel, how do you get around Maxwell, our decision in Maxwell, if you want us to say that we can't look at the exclusions when we're determining coverage? How do you get around that?
Well, Maxwell did in fact quote to the group estoppel rule as being the estoppel rule that is at play in Wisconsin that hasn't been overruled by Maxwell. Because group, the estoppel is not adding to coverage that hasn't been bargained for. It is punishing a breach of a contract. So I believe the court was clear in that decision that the estoppel that was being overruled was not estoppel based upon contractual breaches. It was expanding coverage to something that hadn't been bargained for. And as we look at the case here in front of the court, we have contractually bargained for coverage for Mr. Marks in his role as an investment professional.
When you buy in coverage under an insurance policy, you buy the whole thing. So how can we say you only buy an initial grant of coverage if we would conclude that without looking at the exclusions, which are part of what you also bought as an insured?
The court absolutely should look at the entire policy. At the actual coverage determination stage, what we're looking at here in this case is squarely the duty to defend analysis performed by an insurer extrajudicially with the only evidence in front of it, the notice pleadings. It doesn't have any discovered pleadings. The insurer has no benefit of what the insured might have to say about these pleadings leveled against them. And at that stage, many states, other than Wisconsin, have allowed extrinsic evidence. They have allowed extrinsic evidence to fill in the gap between what may be covered by the policy and what's been alleged. And you have two cases here in front of you where insureds have alleged that there are actual facts out there that entitle them to coverage and that they weren't reflected in the notice pleadings. And so if, in answer to your question, to a roundabout way again, yes, the entire policy should be honored. But at the very infancy of a lawsuit, the insurer has very fact-based policy exclusions that it has the ability, if the law isn't what Groob says it was, to take those exclusions and apply them in almost a summary judgment type setting without full facts, something a court of law here could never do at the infancy of litigation. And I'd also like to highlight that the duty to defend is the possibility of coverage. It's not actual coverage. And so what the court dealt with in Maxwell regarding estoppel, I don't believe should overrule the duty to defend estoppel that was talked about in Groob. And in fact, I believe the court did quote Groob and cited to the exact section of the Groob decision that recognized that estoppel was still going to be set aside and wasn't the main focus of that decision. Now,
are we using the terms duty to indemnify, the term that I'm introducing now, and whether or not there is coverage interchangeably? Let me add another question to make clear where I'm going. Isn't part of the coverage that you get in a policy includes the duty to defend?
It does.
So you have a coverage for the duty to defend.
Yes, Your Honor. Some decisions refer to, in other jurisdictions, the insurance policy is really a litigation policy, and it provides two benefits to the insured, the duty to defend and the separate duty to indemnify.
So are we being precise enough when we talk about the duty to defend as something other than coverage? I mean, that's what it sounds like you're saying. Are you being precise enough? Maybe you are, but tell me. Isn't it really the duty to indemnify you're talking about rather than coverage?
If I understand your point correctly, Your Honor, in Olson and Sustash, this court has one could read the decisions to draw the distinction that there's the duty to defend in two situations on a four corners test. And it is the extrajudicial determination by the insurer as well as the suit for breach of the duty to defend. After that, speed bump's the wrong term. After the hurdle is passed, the court moves on to actual coverage determinations where it accepts extrinsic evidence, where it looks at what the actual coverage boundaries are and what the facts are, both sides' facts, not just the notice pled, and at that point renders a full determination on coverage, and with that, it wrapped up into that becomes a duty to defend. So if, and really the distinction is where the defense counsel was appointed. So in our jurisprudence here in the state, we'll see a distinction between duty to defend cases like Sustash and Olson, where a defense was provided and the insured was passed the duty to defend framework and into the actual coverage framework. Mm-hmm. And Houston Casualty has pointed to that Sustash test as looking at the policy, the insuring agreement, seeing if any exclusions apply, and then seeing if any exceptions to the exclusions apply. The duty to defend, in our view, is before that. It's the limited possibility of coverage. And so what we believe the major weakness inherent in a strict duty to defend, which would be not allowing the extrinsic evidence to come forward. The major hurdle in that is that you do end up with the collateral damage, for lack of a better word, falling on the insured's shoulders, because the insurer is allowed to view a very narrow set of pled facts. The pled facts may be incorrect. The pled facts may be contrary to what actually happened. And the insured.
What I hear you saying in a way is you have a duty to defend until you get out on summary judgment later.
Well, yeah.
All the time.
Certainly. You would have a duty to defend. Well, the duty to defend when you get out on summary judgment, I believe there are, I can't think of the exact case. It might be Elliott. It might be Elliott. But I believe this court has also determined that if you do get out on coverage I'm sorry, if you do get out on the duty to defend, or the duty to defend is determined at the summary judgment phase, the insurer is still responsible for defending throughout the appellate process the merits of those claims against the insured.
So give me an example of when an insurance company would not have a duty to defend if they've written a policy.
An example where the insurer would not have to defend an insured?
Right.
Depending on the type of policy, if it was an auto policy, if the insuring agreement and that policy would insure various, broadly would insure things that happen in the vehicle. If the individual was at home and someone drowned in their pool, that would be an instance where an insurer would not have to defend. But if, and it really is.
Because the label says auto insurance policy?
It would be what's in the insuring agreement. The insuring agreement would control what should or shouldn't be defended by an insurance company.
Without considering the exclusions or exceptions?
Yes, Your Honor. At that stage, and what we're really looking for is the possibility of coverage. And it is the nature of the claims alleged in any particular lawsuit that would trigger that. So depending on the nature of the claims, with the Grube rule, at least the Grube stop rule as we phrase it, looking for lack of a better term, the bar on exclusions that was referenced in Grube, Kenefect, and Radke, what that did is it shrunk the ability, it shrunk the full force of the policy to narrow the gap between the pled facts and what the actual facts might be. It's one way to look at what's happening in other jurisdictions that allow extrinsic evidence. Extrinsic evidence takes the notice pleadings and expands them to meet the full force of the policy exclusions that may be leveled against the actual facts in a full coverage determination.
If we accept your argument here, should we also begin to reconsider jurisprudence that relates to the remedies available if an insured doesn't defend? I mean, the remedies are pretty extreme now. Will that unwind then that area of law?
I don't think, no, Your Honor, I don't think so. The remedies have been clear since professional office buildings, really, and Grube, Kenefic, and Radke built on that. But the penalties have been severe, and they are severe in many jurisdictions. And they need to be severe to ensure that the insurers do the right thing. They're meant to encourage the insurers to defend if there's any possibility of coverage.
What I'm hearing from you, and I need you to help me with it, is there are a lot of policies. I understand your idea that if it's an auto policy and you're being sued for something that couldn't possibly relate to an auto policy, then there's no duty to defend. But there are a lot of insurance policies out there that are far broader in scope than that. Yet, it seems pretty clear the coverage that was purchased may not be as broad as the initial grant of coverage. But I hear you saying, they still have to defend, no matter what. And that's what concerns me a little more than your auto policy example. So can you walk down that path with me a little bit and explain some of the more typical, broader CGL policies or other policies and explain the circumstances under which an insurer would appropriately not have the duty to defend?
Certainly. Your Honor, may I use the policy to issue a professional liability policy and its insuring agreement? The insuring agreement of a professional liability policy, this one at issue was fairly similar to others that any profession, doctor, lawyer, dentist might have. And the insuring agreement insures the professional for acts that might come into play during their practicing of their profession. So for doctors, obviously, it goes to what's happening in the operating room, how they're advising clients, how they're treating the clients. In this instance, the insurance was issued to a trustee of an investment, two investment trusts. And depending on how one takes the scope of that trustee's job, the policy is meant to take in all the facts that might come into play while he's performing his job. So the insuring agreement, by nature of all insurance agreements, are all very broad. And we can see the point that most insuring agreements are broad. Just as the duty to defend is also very broad, and it needs to be, because when a lawsuit is filed against an individual that purchases insurance, we look at what the bargain for coverage expectations are of that insured. The insured is expecting a defense. They're expecting to call up their insurance company and say, I've been sued, and I was doing my job, going back to the professional liability policy. You said you would protect me when I was doing my job. And in instances where an insured can't get the actual facts out, the insurance company can, at least in other jurisdictions, as retreat behind the fortress of the notice pleadings and say, well, that's not in the notice pleading. And so what you're seeing with notice pleadings and the duty to defend is that the notice pleadings are always quite broad, just by nature of being notice pleadings. And the insuring agreement's broad. So regardless of what the test may end up being, you're going to have that breadth of notice pleadings coinciding with the insuring agreement. Whether we stay with the strict duty to defend test or go to a broad test, that problem, to the extent it is a problem, is going to remain just by nature of how insurance is written. But I don't think that by taking away the groove estoppel rule, where you don't let insurers use their exclusions to disclaim coverage, at least at the infancy of the full facts being out there, would affect how insurers are underwriting, and certainly not Wisconsin. These cases, Group, Kenefic, and Dawn, have been on Wisconsin's books since 1990. I think their group came in 1992. Expectation is that insurers have been taking into account published law in the state of Wisconsin and adjusting their risk pools accordingly. The insurers are, as we know, in the risk allocation business. Insurers are in the risk mitigation business.
I used to answering Justice Ziegler's question.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Are you still answering Justice Ziegler's question? If you are, I don't want to interrupt you. If you're not, I have a question.
I have moved on, Your Honor.
Okay. So I want to get back to basics, all right? This is a unilateral decision by the insurance company not to defend your client. Is that right?
That is right.
Another way that the insurance company could have acted is to defend with a reservation of rights or to ask the circuit court to decide whether it had a duty to defend, right?
That is correct.
Okay, so we got two opportunities here for the insurance company to act, and I find those two in the cases. Do you agree?
I do.
All right. Now, we're dealing with the unilateral issue. And if I understood your brief and if I understood these cases, they treat unilateral versus, and I'll call it bilateral, going to court or reservation, differently. You agree with that?
The cases treat unilateral disclaimers of coverage differently than coming into the court and seeking a coverage.
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And in unilateral, if I understand the case law or how you want it interpreted, in the unilateral situation, you look to the policy for its coverage clauses, right?
Yes.
That's a little ambiguous when I say coverage clauses, but for our purposes at the moment, it will do. And it's your position that the case law says you don't look at exclusions. So if the policy covers the trusts here, the two trusts, right? You don't look to see the other part of the policy that excludes other trusts.
That is our reading of Grube, kind of.
I understand that. Okay. All right. And you don't look at exceptions to the exclusions. You just look at the coverage. That's somewhat ambiguous because coverage may be in different parts of the policy.
Yes, sir.
And it may not be labeled coverage, right? But here is your position that the coverage is to these two trusts and the Titan Trust is very related to these two trusts. Therefore, you're covered on a duty to defend. Isn't that your position?
Not entirely, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why.
Good.
Our position is that Mr. Marks was covered for his duties as trustee of the trust, for two investment trusts.
Right.
That in his application, he asked for coverage to cover his work, his profession. The insuring agreement was written to cover his profession for duties he performed solely as trustee. His sitting on the board of Titan was by virtue of...
You're reading then the coverage of the policy differently than I read it. You're saying the coverage covers him as trustee, period. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying the coverage covers him as a professional trustee for investment trust.
Fine.
And what he might do in his role as that.
Right. And I said to you that the policy covered him as trustee of two named trusts. So we have a disagreement as to what the policy's coverage is. Okay? That's
no, you're
fine.
Right. No, you misunderstand me. The policy
okay.
does say that he is covered in his profession as trustee
right.
of two trusts, ICT
right.
and ICT2.
Mm-hmm.
You are correct.
Right. Okay. But you think it's broader. But you don't look at exclusions and you don't look at exceptions. Is that your position?
Not at the extrajudicial duty to defend stage. No, Your Honor.
That's right. Just
That is my position.
That's right. You'd have a different rule if this was a bilateral, that they reserved the right or that they came in and asked the court for duty to defend. They came in and asked the court for duty to defend. That's a full hearing on the policy terms, the complaint terms, extrinsic evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right?
Yes.
And you want us to retain those two distinctions.
That is what we ask for, Your Honor.
That's right. And the court here, both the trial court with Judge Sankovitz and the Court of Appeals said, those cases that Abrahamson and Merck cite as differentiating between unilateral and a circuit court bifurcation, they don't say that. They have been misinterpreted. They have no basis to say that. And there's only one rule, and you look at everything. It's the bifurcation rule. Isn't that what the Court of Appeals said and the Circuit Court said?
Very close, Your Honor, if I could add a distinction to that.
Sure.
The Court of Appeals recognized that the Group, Kennefec, and Dawn laws were out, the rule was out there.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't take Sustash and say Sustash overrules these. It said they were never, that they never had the proper power to have those as a rule.
Sustash said there was a, you had, that the insurance company had already given a defense. It went, it gave the defense, so we're no longer talking about duty to defend. We are now into indemnification.
Correct, Your Honor.
Isn't that Sustash?
That is Sustash.
Yeah. And they used the word coverage on the duty to defend and said, okay, you already did that. We're not going to fight about that. We're going to defend. Question is indemnification.
Correct, because defense counsel had been provided and the insured had been protected from the liability action.
Right. And in Maxwell, the issue was that even though the insurance company didn't issue the notice of reservation of rights, that its right of to contest coverage survived.
Yes.
They just read it a little broader, as if they had reserved rights.
And in Maxwell, the insured was trying to leverage the failure of the insurer
right.
to issue that reservation of rights to get coverage they weren't entitled to.
Right. So what you did is it pushed it into the second category of asking the trial court for bifurcation or reservation of rights. That's Maxwell.
Yes, Your Honor.
I understand it. So you just want to go back to what I always thought was the law in the state, and you put it as one track, two tracks. I put it as unilateral, and I use the word bilateral or bifurcation. I have another question for you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you familiar with the next case we're about to hear?
I am fairly familiar.
Did you cite it?
I did, yes.
Yeah,
but we did.
That's what I thought. Okay. Are they consistent, the two Court of Appeals decisions in the Water Wells case and in this case? Are they consistent?
Well, on the duty to defend...
On the issue of duty to defend, bilateral, unilateral, that's a unilateral case. Okay.
Yes. My recollection is that they're consistent in not applying the Grube, Kenefick, and Dawn rule and allowing exclusions. If there are some other nuances in Waterwell regarding possibly Grebe and its effect on extrinsic evidence, but yes.
So essentially they take the same position, namely don't divide this into unilateral and bilateral, or to use my terms or to use one or two your terms, treat it all the same. And if the duty to defend, no matter when it's raised, you'll look at everything. That's the way I read these two cases.
Yes, Your Honor.
You read them that way?
I do.
Okay.
Could I ask, in how many cases should the insurance company have provided an offense, in your view?
All six.
Six cases?
Yes, they were six fairly contemporaneously filed cases, all of which were noticed to the insurance company at the same time, and all of which the insured had quite difficulty getting the insurance company to rule on them. So, yes, rule on the duty to defend on them and make its extrajudicial analysis. But, yes, in all six cases, the insured, Mr. Marks, was entitled to a defense.
Okay. If the insurer had moved for bifurcation, how many times would the insurer have had to do that?
Well, if the jurisdictions of those lawsuits were across the United States, if the insurer took that, took that track, it would have been six separate bifurcations. However, the insurer could have come to Wisconsin and filed a declaratory judgment action in a state court in the state of Wisconsin or a federal court while providing a defense to the insured as coverage was hashed out.
There's no way they could have bifurcated and not done it six times?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, because of the six separate jurisdictions. Perhaps a procedural attempt to consolidate coverage actions and move individually into each of those jurisdictions and seek those stays and then have a court here declare the coverage might have been a possibility. I am not familiar with each of those jurisdictions' procedures. Houston Casualty has intimated without citation that it wasn't possible to bifurcate in some of those jurisdictions. I haven't seen citations for that. I don't know if that's correct or not.
What state law governs in all these six cases? Is it Wisconsin?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, my light's on.
Yes.
The question again.
I want to know what state law governs in each of these six.
Wisconsin insurance law should govern in each of those states. It's Wisconsin policy.
So that if the case is in Maine, they'd apply what you want is the two-track system. Even though Maine would, if the Maine law applied, treat bilateral and unilateral the same.
I would hope that those jurisdictions would recognize that bifurcation was proper under Wisconsin law and under a conflicts of law analysis, apply our law and bifurcate and stay, allowing the coverage to be determined as our Wisconsin insurer to bargain for.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are you ready to proceed?
Please the court. Aidan McCormack, counsel for Houston Casualty Company, the defendant and respondent here. I think one thing is clear in this case, and that is that the business risk exclusion bars coverage. And unless this court is going to adopt a new so-called Grube estoppel rule or a new sometimes called dual track rule, the result is fairly straightforward. And the Court of Appeals should be affirmed. The Grube estoppel rule is a rule created by Mr. Marks to serve his own purposes in this case. It is not a rule that was created by this court, and the Court of Appeals has already rejected it for good reason. The rule derives from Grube, but Grube derives the rule from professional offices. And professional offices looks back on two of your decisions, one going back 50 years, the Grebe case. Both Grebe and Solar Basic are unilateral denial of coverage cases. In both cases, this court considered both the insuring clause and the exclusions in deciding whether there was a breach of the duty to defend. In Grebe, the court concluded there was no such breach. In Solar Basic, the court concluded there was a breach. But the point is that both cases followed the correct analysis. And the breach in Solar Basic resulted in the waiver of all defenses. But the breach decision was reached considering the policy as a whole as should be done. Professional office buildings followed that line of reasoning. Professional office buildings was a matter involving an aircraft exclusion with an exception in the exclusion for independent contractor conduct. In professional office building, in looking at the policy and the four corners of the complaint, sometimes called the eight corners test, the whole policy, four corners, and the whole complaint, four corners, the court concluded that the complaint at issue specifically alleged independent contractor activity, and therefore professional services reached the conclusion that there was a breach of the duty to defend. Why was there a breach? Because there was an exception to the exclusion. They wouldn't have considered the exception to the exclusion without considering the exclusion. How did we get Grube? I've read it so many times, I sometimes dream about it. But when you read Grube carefully, you look and see that they're asserting the owned property exclusion in that case. And it is an underground storage leak case. And the concept being that some of these materials might have migrated off the property and therefore triggered coverage. But the way at least I read Grube is I think the Court of Appeals may have been a little too harsh on itself in this case. When I read Grube, I see a court that was asking whether or not the insuring clause barred a duty to defend solely because the exclusion was never asserted as a bar to the duty to defend, because the exclusion couldn't bar the duty to defend because there was on and off-site damage. The reason the exclusion came up is after the fact, when the insurance company said, wait a second, we know we breached the duty to defend under the insuring clause, but we want to use the exclusion to allocate damages on the indemnity side. And they applied the same rule that this court has been applying since Grebe and elsewhere and said, no, you can't use the exclusion on the indemnity phase because you breached the duty to defend under the insuring agreement. Mark's proposed rule, respectfully, is unworkable, it's unjust, and it doesn't have grounding in any of the law and contract interpretation. The duty to defend is a creature of contract, nothing more. It appears in some policies. Some insurance policies don't contain a duty to defend. And the duty to defend is not limited to insurance policies. Bear in mind, we see it in leases and other types of indemnification provisions. But it is, at its nub, a contractual obligation. And how, then, could we consider the question of whether that contractual obligation is triggered by only looking at part of the contract at issue? It simply doesn't make sense. We've searched and found no state in the United States that have ever reached such a conclusion. We challenged Mr. Marks to do the same, and he, too, found no law outside of this jurisdiction on that issue.
Well, I didn't find any law either, but let's just explore some basics. One, do we agree that the duty to defend can be greater than the duty to indemnify?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Why?
because that is the holding of this and other courts.
That's
right. The duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify. It can be. They can be the same.
It can, yeah. Because the duty to defend, we don't know whether the insured is ultimately going to be found liable for whatever the complaint, the third-party complaint says, right?
That's right.
All right. That's why they're not equal. All right. Now, I have, and this case raised, this case and the next one raised the question of whether I'm just been mistaken. I always thought there were two lines of cases in Wisconsin. One, what is referred to as the unilateral, right, where the insurance company just says no, right? And that there's another line of cases that says it's a different rule if the insurance company has a reservation of rights or seeks to intervene and then bifurcate, right? I mean, that's what these Court of Appeals cases seem to say.
I would respectfully disagree.
Okay.
And I
Why?
Can articulate if you'd like.
Well, let me just see if we can
sure.
cut right through. I think you disagree, as did the Circuit Court and did the Court of Appeals, because when you look at these cases hard, they're as I read the two decisions, that they're fluff. There's nothing that supports that. They're thin air cases.
Correct, Your Honor.
I mean, that's your position, in effect. They're made up. There's no support for them in other cases, and therefore it's correct to say we've got to get rid of them.
I'd be hesitant to use the word made up. They are published decisions, but what I would say is
okay.
Grube, for the reasons I stated, is perhaps misunderstood.
Okay.
And the two cases that followed it both picked up on the rule without any other citation in pure dicta. And therefore, because the exclusions weren't at issue in those cases.
All right.
So especially put in the well of all the other cases, Grebe and so many others, that really address the issue, we come to the conclusion that there is no such Grube estoppel rule, dual-track rule, whatever name is being used at the moment.
You're the lawyer, and you have to be more respectful, so you can say all that, and I can say they're made up.
That's true,
right?
Your Honor.
That it's dicta, there's nothing to support them in any authority, and they're fluff.
That's right, Your Honor.
I mean, you should use different terminology, but I'm trying to see if we don't really agree on, as I have stated it. All right. So is it your position that once you have a duty to defend case, and it's a unilateral case, like this one?
Yes, Your Honor.
The trial court and an appellate court can examine the entire policy, that's the four corners, right?
Yes.
And the entire third-party complaint, that's another four corners, and take extrinsic evidence.
No, Your Honor.
No extrinsic evidence?
Well, let me back up to the very beginning.
Okay.
You said the entire complaint. If you're talking about the complaint against the insured...
I'm talking about the third-party complaint against the insured.
Okay. Whatever the claim is against the insured,
yeah.
be it a first-party complaint or third-party
right.
complaint,
okay.
in this case, there was a number of different ones, but whatever that claim is,
right.
whatever that claim that is pled in court,
right.
that is, under the four corners rule, what is considered.
Yeah.
And under
okay.
a wealth authority,
good.
Only that.
We agree. And the other four corners come from the insurance policy.
Correct, Your Honor.
All right. So the court can look at both. Can the court look at extrinsic evidence?
No, Your Honor. In this case, it makes no difference whether you do or don't, but they cannot.
I'm trying to find a rule
yes.
of law.
Very good.
So if there was extrinsic evidence showing the intent of the parties, and you could bring it in under parole evidence rule or whatever, can the court look at it in determining the duty to defend?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because it has long been the law of this court that the four corners rule makes good sense. And the four corners rule does make good sense. remember that the plaintiff is the master of the pleading. It is the plaintiff who is making the claim. It is the plaintiff who ultimately at trial will bear the burden of proof. So therefore, the question of what claim is being made against the insured, the question of what suit is the obligation to defend arising from, comes rightly from the four corners of the complaint.
Okay.
And it should not come from extrinsic evidence. It's a very deep rabbit hole, extrinsic evidence. If I say I want to use extrinsic evidence to trigger coverage, I bring this in, can the insurance company say, well, we have some extrinsic evidence too?
Mm-hmm.
It shows there is no coverage. Which extrinsic evidence is better? It creates chaos, and the rule of law makes sense because you're looking at the actual claim against the insured as opposed to wandering off into a questionable area. We are, of course, talking about the duty to defend.
Right. Now, in this case, let us assume that the insurance company knows that the insured, that's your company, knows that the insured is all tied up with Titan.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
That the insurance company knows, let us assume that the there's evidence that the insurance company knows that the insured in this case, as the trustee of the two named trusts, is involved in the is it Titan?
Titan Indemnity, director
yeah.
and officer.
Right.
Yes, I see.
And that the insurance company knows that, and therefore the insured, the reasonable expectation of the insured was that he, Marks, was being covered for Titan. Suppose that's the extrinsic evidence. You would say it can't be brought in. Is that right?
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's not the case here.
Well, we don't have to debate that because we're not up to that.
Yes.
So do we have to reverse or withdraw language from all the Court of Appeals cases that have been cited here?
Not at all, Your Honor. If we're talking, and I believe we are still, only about the duty to defend test.
Right, that's what we're talking
about.
Based
upon the four corners of the insurance contract and the four corners of the claim against the insurer,
right.
whatever
that's
form
right.
it comes.
You think that fits within, and in a unilateral situation, that fits within these old cases?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
And, for example, certainly Grebe and Solar Basic say exactly that. So does professional office services, office buildings, excuse me, which follows Grebe and Solar Basic and applies that very well-known rule of law in an exception to an exclusion circumstance to the detriment of the insurer there, but so be it.
So the Court of Appeals wasn't doing anything wrong here. That is, it wasn't overruling its own prior cases, which under Cook is arguably they can't do.
No, not at all, Your Honor. When it analyzed the situation, it looked back, as did Judge Stankovitz, quite well and in quite depth in his own research on this matter, and realized that Grube had some language in it that was not correct, and it was relying on professional office buildings, which had the correct rule of law, and professional office buildings was looking back at Solar Basic and also at Grebe, both of which had the correct rule of law. So if anything, Grube respectfully walked away from the rulings of this court.
Okay. So did we wind up with the same rule relating to the duty to defend in unilateral cases and bilateral cases?
No, you don't, Your Honor.
Why not?
I believe that the distinction lies in this. While you review the whole policy in making the determination, if in a unilateral breach of contract case there is a ruling that there was a duty to defend, then you would waive all exclusions and other defenses, not just the exclusions, the policy as a whole, at least up to the policy limits.
Now, another issue in this case that wasn't talked about by opposing counsel, but I will ask about it on rebuttal, is the claim that the policy is illusory if we read it as you are reading it. Do you want to address that for me, please, and
yep.
give me your best argument about why the coverage is not illusory?
Okay. So the argument comes from Mr. Mark's position that exclusion B1 is it swallows the policy as a whole.
Right.
And exclusion B1, as we know, provides that Mr. Marks is not insured in his capacity in any other position outside of his capacity that's designated in the declarations. The declarations, of course, designates by endorsement, because it's a manuscript endorsement, that he's insured solely in his performance professional services as trustee for the children's trusts. The reading that Marks takes on that exclusion is that the lowercase t trusts word in it actually is all trusts, including the more specific capital T trusts as defined in the policy. It's the first time in 25 years of doing insurance law that I've seen an insured argue the exclusion is broader than the insurance company believes it is, but so be it. The view is reached only by violating at least three rules of contract construction. First, the specific, as we know, always takes over the more general. In this case, the capital T trusts clearly refers to the trusts that are insured under the policy. It also it defies the law that illusory contracts are not to be found on a ready basis. And third, it's simply contrary to the sentence which clearly refers to the trust designated in the declarations, which, of course, refers you to the endorsement. So on that basis, we certainly agree with Judge Stankovich and the Court of Appeals that the contract is not illusory and that Mr. Marks has not met his heavy burden to prove that. I've been talking a little bit about the rule that Marks proposes, and I just want to bring one sort of example to your attention I think is helpful. When Mr. Marks talks about auto policies and other type of policies, I believe the question was asked, would there ever be a situation where there wasn't a duty to defend? And I sat there and tried to imagine some myself, and it was very hard. Remember that a homeowner's policy naturally contains an auto exclusion. We probably all have one. But in determining whether it had a duty to defend an auto case, a homeowner's insurer would have to defend that case. They couldn't unilaterally deny an auto accident case under a homeowner's policy. Vice versa, an auto policy, an auto insurer gets tendered a homeowner injury. The auto insurer has no choice but to defend that case because the auto policy contains a specific limitation, limiting language that under this new rule meant we couldn't use such limiting language, which says that the auto policy doesn't apply to anything outside of the use of the automobile. It would create utter chaos. Anytime you had a duty defense situation that was so obvious, like this case here, that required a denial, and that goes on a regular basis when there is a tender of a lawsuit that simply just doesn't fit within the terms of the contract, you would simply have to defend, file a DJ action, intervene, bifurcate. In this case, apparently six different times, it's a rule of impossibility. It would require insurers for the state of Wisconsin to remove exclusions or find a way to make them part of the insuring clause, a total redrafting of the contracts. Respectfully, it simply makes no sense. And I think Judge Stankovich said it best when he said, "You can see that this rule Mr. Mark invokes sounds so peculiar that it raises a host of concerns for the court. In fact, these concerns about Mr. Mark's rule asks me to apply, cause me to think hard about whether there actually is such a rule, whether the rule is sound, and whether I am really required to follow it." 156:27. We know what he ultimately concluded. There was no such rule, and it wasn't sound either. And the Court of Appeals repeated his comments and concerns about the rule, stating, "We note that Grube, Kenneflick, and Radke do not merely conflict with professional office buildings. They unnecessarily create a modified duty to defend test that is counterintuitive and confusing." That's at paragraph 16 of that decision. The business risk exclusion here clearly applies. Mr. Marks was sued as shareholder and equitable owner of Titan, chairman of Titan, chairman of USA Detergents, and a board member of Appalachian Oil Company. For example, in Appalachian Oil, the allegations were that the debtor, ABCO, made distributions in the amount of not less than $4.9 million. At the time the distributions were made to Titan, Marks was acting as a member of ABCO's board of directors. The six Titan actions are classic examples of claims that would ordinarily be tendered to a D&O carrier under the D&O policies issued to the companies it issues. Whether that happened or why that insurance wasn't in play if it wasn't is beside the point. This is a special kind of insurance contract. It is not a broad insurance contract. It is a professional liability policy. And if we look at the Grieve decision, that case discusses this very issue and points out that there is a difference, because I believe that's the only other E&O case that we have to look to, that a professional liability policy is a specialized form of insurance that provides coverage for the person in that profession. In the opening remarks by counsel, he referred to Mr. Marks as an investment specialist, an investment advisor, an investment trustee of some kind. But that's not the purchase he covered. There is financial advisor professional liability policies. He did not procure one. He procured a policy solely, and that word was specifically written into the policy, for him as trustee. Houston Casualty made the right and indeed only decision it could make in this case. The underlying cases were not, as counsel told you, filed simultaneously. They were filed at various points in time. When Houston Casualty first received these not notice pleadings, six complex, detailed complaints, they had been litigated by counsel of Marx's choosing for almost a year and a half. Wisconsin is a direct action state, and some of the law here derives from that fact, but none of the five underlying jurisdictions that these cases are in were in a direct action state. A motion to intervene, which would have had to have been made in six different litigations, would have likely resulted in sanctions. It's not permissible. So that option was not available for several reasons. The cases were advanced, and there wasn't allowable. Remember also,
is it your position that, and this is your cross petition for review, in effect, is it your position that the Court of Appeals didn't address it, but that we should, that the previous lawsuits filed against Marks fall within the initial grant of coverage, or don't fall within the grant, or fall within the exclusions? What's your position on the merits of the case?
Yeah. On the merits of the case, Your Honor, our position is that it does not fall within the insuring clause, and we respectfully disagree with Judge Sankovitz on that.
Pardon me?
We disagree with Judge Sankovitz on that. But that in any event, exclusion B1, which I refer to as the business risk exclusion, applies. And of course, you also have exclusion A for fraud. Even Mr. Marks admits in page 22 of his brief that the Hawaii Global case was entirely a fraud, as it was. And the Court of Appeals gave a detailed description of each of the six underlying cases in its decision, which I commend you to read. But as the Court of Appeals recognizes, Judge Sankovitz recognized, the allegations and the substance of all these underlying cases is for fraud and intentional misconduct. Exclusion A is very broad. And to touch upon, do you want all of the merits, Your Honor? Is this helpful?
Well, are we going to have to reach it if we hold for you on the initial issue of what the court considers in its eight concepts of looking at the eight corners of the two documents?
No, Your Honor. These
Why
issues
not?
Become because they become moot.
Because
the only thing that I would add is that, at least from Houston Casualty, it has nothing to gain on it, but I believe that addressing the insuring clause issue is appropriate, and that one looks at the insuring clause, recognizes the precedent set about D&O policies in Grieve, and looks at the complaints here, I don't think it's fairly debatable that these complaints don't fit within even the insuring clause of the policy.
I have another question for you. Having given my colleagues the opportunity to ask you questions in this interim, do you Do you have read Waterwell's opinion?
I have read it, Your Honor. I wouldn't say I'm a scholar on it, but please.
All right. Does on your reading not being solid, do they look consistent to you with regard to what is examined by a court on duty to defend in a unilateral fact situation?
Yes, Your Honor. I think they're in keeping with Grebe and with Solar Basic.
They have other issues, but at least
yes,
on this
right.
main issue.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
I see my red light's on. May I add one point?
Very briefly. Okay.
I will be very brief. Two items to hit quickly. One is I had been asked about extrinsic evidence, and I did want to expound upon it briefly. Extrinsic evidence makes no difference in this case. The underwriting information is incorporated into the policy solely for purpose of the truth of the allegations. That's at 1:30 of the record. Doesn't matter if you look at the underwriting information, please have at it, because there's Titan, U.S. detergents, Appalachian Oil. He never disclosed any of these entities to us when he asked for insurance. And last but not least, if you were going to take one site down, 93:92. The Houston casualty underwriter specifically questioned Marks on what else he was doing and was told that essentially it's none of your business. And the Houston casualty underwriter did something phenomenal. She did what she should have done. She said, we just want to be clear that there is no coverage for anything other than his work for the trust. It was responded to by Mr. Marks through his broker and confirmed it. At the end of the day, unless you're going to create a new rule that the lower courts and Houston Casualty respectfully commit are confusing and create chaos, this case should be readily affirmed.
I'm
Thank
glad
you, very
you
much.
Talked about extrinsic evidence, because I'm not sure I agree with you when you say it shouldn't be looked at once you open the door to everything else. But your position is here, it's not needed. And if you do look at it, it supports you.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Chief Justice Rogensack, may it please the court. I'm James Friedman. I'm with the Madison Office of Godfrey and Kahn, and I'm here representing Amicus Curiae, the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance, and the American Insurance Association. I want to particularly thank the court for the opportunity to participate today, particularly on such short notice. I'd like to make 3 points, and in doing so, respond to some of the arguments made by Mr. Mark's counsel, and I will try not to be repetitive. First, the process in Wisconsin to decide insurance coverage disputes is fair. In fact, it generally and appropriately is intended to favor the insured. There is but a single test at the duty to defend stage. Both the insurer and the insured have a right to seek a ruling on the duty to defend, and that issue is determined based on the four corners of the complaint, the facts as pled, and the four corners of the insurance policy, including both the coverage grant and the exclusions, and for that matter, exceptions to the exclusions. No extrinsic evidence is permitted at that time either for the insurer or the insured. And if coverage is even fairly debatable, in other words, if it's a close call, the insurer must defend. Mr. Marks suggests this is unfair, and he refers in his briefs to, quote, fact-based exclusions, and, quote, as if exclusions alone require facts. The reality is everything is fact-based in determining insurance coverage. The question isn't whether facts are relevant. The question is whether it's facts as pled, which is what we look at the duty to defend stage, or whether it's evidence that's proven, which is what we look at if we're determining actual coverage or the duty to indemnify. And again, there is a single test under Wisconsin law for the duty to indemnify or actual insurance coverage. And again, both the insurer and the insured have a right to seek a ruling on coverage. And you can rely on extrinsic evidence at that point. Mr. Marks had a right in this case. He suggested his hands were tied. That's not true. He could have sought a trial on coverage and put evidence into the record. He chose not to do that. I assume there's a strategic reason for it. Point number two, there simply is no Grebe estoppel rule. Justice Abrahamson, there is no distinction in Wisconsin between what happens as using your terminology when a unilateral decision is made by the insurer versus when the issue is put initially before a court. Grube is an anomaly. If you look at all of the cases before Grube and all the cases after Grube, the courts looked at exclusions at the duty to defend stage. And that makes sense, and it avoids absurd results. It makes sense because whether language is in the coverage grant or whether it's in exclusions is really a matter of drafting for the insurance company. And it does not make a lot of sense to have an arbitrary drafting decision be determinative on coverage. And as Mr. McCormick...
Mr. Friedman?
Yes, Justice Ramson.
If you take the broad view of what you look at in duty to defend, then isn't the duty to defend equal to the duty to indemnify in the sense that you assume there's a duty to identify? You assume that Mr. Marks did something wrong as trustee, and therefore he'd be liable and the insurance company would be liable on the duty to indemnify. So you have to defend him on the assumption that you're going to indemnify, except to the extent that you don't have to defend him because the coverage, that is, what is covered and what's excluded and what's accepted, takes them out of the policy. Isn't that your position, really?
No. With all due respect, I would disagree. I don't think there are assumptions on coverage. I don't think you can start to assume anything until you have looked at the duty to defend stage, looked at the complaint, and looked at the policy. The policy may have nothing to do with what's at issue in the complaint, and I think that's what Mr. McCormick was getting at with some of his examples and where I was headed as well. So I don't think Wisconsin courts have used the word you have to assume coverage just because your insured sends you a demand letter or a complaint. There's no assumption. At that point, it's the obligation of the insurer to look at the four corners of the two documents. And again, it avoids absurd results. And Mr. McCormick's example with the homeowner's insurer having to defend an auto claim despite a very clear exclusion is a great example. There are others, though. If Mr. Mark's rule is correct, then when a commercial general liability insurer gets a complaint for a workplace injury and consistent with Wisconsin workers' compensation law, I see my red light is on. May I finish my point?
Finish your point, yes.
Thank you very much. Decides that they're not going to defend because there's no way there could be coverage. They exclude workplace injuries because there's workers' compensation insurance mandatorily. Now they're going to have to defend for a while. They're going to have to fight about coverage. They can't just make this common sense decision.
Thank you very much.
Justice Prosser has a question.
And so does Justice Bradley.
Good.
All right. Justice Bradley, why don't you proceed, and then we'll go to Justice Prosser.
Thank you. I'm taken by your comment that there is no Grube rule. And I've been trying to digest Arne Anderson's treatise on all of this. And he has several pages on the Grube rule. Have you had an opportunity to look at his treatise beforehand and before arguing here today? And if so...
I have to be honest, Justice Bradley, I did not review. I'm very familiar with Mr. Anderson's treatise, and it generally does a nice job of summarizing Wisconsin law. What I did look at, though, which Mr. Marks pointed out as well, is Appleman, which also does a very good job summarizing the country's insurance coverage law. And Appleman is cited in Grube, but Grube gets Appleman wrong. Appleman does not say that at this stage you can't look at exclusions. The cases Appleman cites actually are the next stage, and I think that's where the language in Grube comes from. If a court determines that an insurer has improperly denied a defense, so then after we've got a decision in this case, at that point, you may not be able to rely on exclusions. But at the point when the court is deciding whether there was a duty to defend, you can look at exclusions. And Appleman says nothing to the contrary, even though Grube relied on it.
Justice Prosser?
Obviously, the insurer can litigate officer up front whether they have a duty to defend. And I understood you to say that the a person in Mr. Mark's position also can do that.
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, in that case, Mr. Marx would have to hire his own attorney to litigate that?
Correct, which obviously he did in this case.
And if he wins that issue, does the insurer pay for his attorney?
I think if the insurer inappropriately denied the defense, then that potentially flows from that improper denial, and this court's jurisprudence would say that would be part of the remedy for the improper denial of the defense.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. I have a few quick points in rebuttal. The Appleman version that was relied upon by the Group Court, I urge the court to go back and look at that citation. Group, that citation from professional office buildings and Group, I believe, where it was cited, does state that exclusionary language should not be used in a breach of duty defending analysis. I would also like the court, sorry, I'm talking quickly here, I'm trying to cover a lot of ground here. I would like the court to examine the record on a statement made by Houston Casualty's counsel that Mr. Marks's agent was somehow asked whether to clarify his professional duties. The record cite is 93, 92, 96, and some of them might be at App 179.
Do you agree that you could have filed a lawsuit and asked for a determination of coverage?
Thank you, Your Honor. Actually, he did. One of our claims was for a declaratory judgment action on this for actual coverage. We never got to get we never got there. The court stopped a duty to defend, did not allow extrinsic evidence in, and we never got to that state. So I'm not sure where that necessarily is.
What case is that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What case is that? Where did you do that?
In this case. This case, one of our claims, one of Mr. Marks's claims was for a breach of duty to defend,
right,
was for a declaration of coverage,
okay,
for a breach of contract claim,
okay,
as well as some Chapter 618 claims. So in this lawsuit,
Before Judge Sankovic, you asked the judge to determine whether there was coverage.
Well, that was one of our claims. We moved for summary judgment on duty to defend,
okay,
and we never got past that stage. We ended up here having moved for duty to defend. We brought to the judge's attention that if we're looking at the duty to defend, we can't bring in extrinsic evidence. We moved on the duty to defend first. We still had actual coverage claims that have not seen the light of day, but that was one of the claims that Mr. Marks did ask for relief on.
Okay, thank you.
As far as Justice Ziegler, I apologize for not getting to your full question on the insuring agreement, but insuring agreements have definitions, and in them, wrongful act definition and other definitions. In particular, because I don't have CGL policy language in front of me, I'd like to point out in this particular policy, the insuring agreement is keyed to wrongful acts. Wrongful acts are defined in the policy. Wrongful acts are defined as actions within his professional ambit of duties. So in policies general, if we just look at the insuring agreement and don't let insurers look at exclusions at that infancy of the notice pled factual stage, they still have ways to disclaim coverage. It's not Katie bar the door, open everything to coverage, they have to cover everything. The insuring agreements do have limitations and they're laid out in the various definitions. Now, I would like to point out in the definition in this case, part of the policy that Mr. Marks applied for, the application in this case was appended to the policy. It's part of the policy. In the application, Mr. Marks clearly asked for coverage for management of its and subsidiaries' investments of the trusts. It's part of the policy. We're on a four corners duty to defend analysis. That should be part of the policy and what was or was not expected for coverage. So to state that Mr. Marks A, didn't tell the insurance company what he was doing or that what type of business he was in, I don't think is borne out by the record. Nor do I believe the record supports statements that they tried to clarify his duties. It was a subject of a motion to strike at the appellate court level. It was argued at the trial court level. There's great record on exactly what's going on and what they're trying to convince the court of. They tried it at every level. And at every level, we have objected to that characterization of the record. Those communications are between Houston Casualty and its chosen surplus lines agent in Wisconsin, which is part of this, which is Bedford Underwriters. Bedford Underwriters was not Mr. Marks's agent. Mr. Marks had his own insurance agent, and there's nothing in the record to indicate that Bedford Underwriters or Houston Casualty went to Mr. Marks's agent or Mr. Marks and asked him to clarify what was in the applications. It's just not there. As far as intentional acts, Houston Casualty said he shouldn't get coverage because these were intentional acts. Well, policy condition 5 of their policy has an exception to intentional acts. It says intentional acts exclusion is does not apply to situations where the individual insured did not personally participate or personally acquiesce or remain passive after personal knowledge thereof of any of the alleged acts. Well, that sounds to me like that's a jury determination of coverage. They took that language as well as all these lawsuits and just decided that they would not defend him. Instead of having a jury or a court look at extrinsic evidence and air out those issues in their policy. I don't believe that their policy is as cut and dry as they represent. I would like to point out that counsel for Houston Casualty spoke about Solo Basic and Grieve. Grieve, as we pointed out in our brief, was a case that was before this court prior to notice pleadings. Pleadings were much more specific back then. Grieve put in place the Four Corners duty to defend test. Since that time, we now have notice pleadings. And I think some of the problems that we've seen in our case law, the natural progression of these cases, is seeing what the problems of a notice pleading have on the Four Corners. And that's really what the court in Fitzpatrick in New York looked at. Now, there was a dissent there, and the dissent was, well, if we allow extrinsic evidence in, it's going to complicate things. This is an easy test, a simple test. Well, what could be even simpler is the current group test. It doesn't allow insurers to look at their full policy language and all their exclusions and all these fact-based items. The group test is the simplest duty to defend test there is. You look at the insuring agreement, you look at the pleadings. I'm sorry.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
And thank you all for very good arguments and also excellent briefs. They were very, very helpful. We are going to take a brief recess now before we begin our second case for the morning so that these students can leave and some other students can join us. So thank you very much. We are adjourned.